Now, Buddhism doesn't, of course, deny that there may be pleasant experiences in life as well as painful ones. We saw the other week that feeling is pleasant and neutral as well as painful. But Buddhism says that even the pleasant experiences are at bottom painful. The pleasant experiences themselves are really only concealed suffering. Suffering, as it were, glossed over. The guilt on the pill, as it were. And the extent to which we can see this, the extent to which we can see the suffering behind the pleasure, the extent to which we can see, to borrow a metaphor from classical mythology, the skulls and bones behind the banks of flowers in the Siren's caves, depends on our spiritual maturity. Dr. Konza gives four interesting examples of concealed suffering. In the first, something which is pleasant for oneself involves suffering for other people, for other beings. Now, usually, we don't think of this aspect. If we're all right, if we're having a good time, we don't bother too much or too often about others. There's a well-known little army saying, which some of you may know, it expresses this attitude of mind perfectly well. No need to repeat it. To take a common example, suppose you take meat eating, carrion eating. I don't know how many people have enjoyed their roast beef and Yorkshire pudding today, but many people who do enjoy roast beef or whatever it happens to be, they don't bother very much about the sufferings of the cow or the pig or the lamb or the chicken or whatever other unfortunate animal it happens to be. Some of us, a few months ago, attended at Kensington College of Psychic Science Miss Ruth Harrison's lecture on animals as machines, which was illustrated by slides. And some of the slides showed very, very shocking sights indeed. Showed very clearly how much suffering is involved for so many animals just to give us the pleasure, if it is that, of eating meat. But most of the time, the conscious mind just ignores all that. It goes on merrily plying knife and fork without thinking about the suffering of the animals at all. But the unconscious mind is aware. The unconscious mind knows. Very often the unconscious mind is wiser than the conscious mind. You can't fool, you can't deceive the unconscious mind. You can shut something out, some unpleasant fact out from the conscious mind, but where does it go? It just goes down. It sinks down into the unconscious, and it's there all the time. And you don't know it, at least the conscious mind doesn't know it. And it's because of this sort of unconscious knowledge, that there's also an unconscious feeling of guilt. Because in the depths of ourselves we know that our own pleasure has been bought at the expense of the suffering of other living beings. And this guilt is the source of a great deal of uneasiness, a great deal of anxiety, and a great deal of suffering. It was quite interesting to read some, I think it was a year or two ago, that the pilot who dropped, if it was the pilot, I don't know who exactly is responsible, who dropped the first atom bomb on Japan, on Hiroshima, died in a lunatic asylum, in a mental hospital in America, having been almost completely insane for 2 or 3 years. That's rather significant. Dr. Konza gives a different example, a rather milder one, but a quite common one. He gives the example of wealth. He says, in one of his books, that he's known quite a few wealthy people, and they've nearly always been afraid of becoming poor. Now, it's a strange thing. A poor person isn't afraid of dying of starvation or anything like that, strange as it may seem. I've known people in India who don't really know where their next week's meal is coming from, sometimes not even their next day's meal, But you don't find them worrying about it. You find them perfectly cheerful, sometimes even quite happy. But wealthy people, so Dr. Konza says, are often afraid of becoming poor, afraid of losing their wealth. And why is this? He says it's because unconsciously they feel that they don't deserve to have it. The unconscious says it ought to be taken away from you, and the conscious mind says, well, perhaps it will be taken away from you, and why is it? Unconscious guilt feelings are there very often in the mind of the wealthy person, because he knows, however much his conscious mind may deny it, that he's acquired his wealth in various dishonest ways by causing suffering to other people, directly or indirectly. And he therefore very often feels a constant need for self-justification. He says, I earn my money, I contribute to the well-being of the community. It's a social service, and so on and so forth. Or else he may say, well, if I'm rich and other people are poor, it's because I work harder, others are lazy, good for nothing, and so on. But sometimes the feeling of guilt becomes very, very strong indeed, and drastic measures are required to relieve it. Very drastic indeed, consisting sometimes even in giving away some of the wealth. giving away in the form of donation, usually to the church, very often to a hospital. This is rather significant because hospitals relieve suffering, you see. So he's compensating for the suffering he has caused in acquiring the wealth by giving some of it to alleviate physical suffering in the hospitals. This sort of donation is what we call conscience money. If one has anything to do with religious organisations, one very quickly learns how common a thing conscience money is. Sometimes it's just put through the letterbox. Many hospitals have this experience in envelopes, simply inscribed from an anonymous donor. Then you know that someone's conscience is really biting him. Now the second sort of example which Dr. Konza gives is this. That something is pleasant, but it's tied up with anxiety because we're afraid of losing it. Now, a very good example of this sort of thing, which is very pleasant to enjoy and to exercise, but which is tied up with very great anxiety of losing it, is, of course, political power. It's very sweet, so people say, to exercise, to have power over other people. But all the time, you're afraid of losing it. You're afraid even in a democratic country, and especially you're afraid if you're a dictator, if your political power has been wrested by force, if there are all sorts of other people greedy to seize it from you, then you may not have a single easy night's rest. It must be a very terrible thing. The state of mind of a person of this sort must be very terrible indeed. To be surrounded by guards, to always suspicious, not even able to trust your best friends. Always wondering who is going to make the next move, whether you ought to wear your bulletproof vest the next time you go out or not. So think of the state of mind of a person of this sort. Buddhist texts give a very good illustration. They say, suppose there's a hawk. The hawk seizes a piece of meat and flies off with it in its claws. And what happens? Hundreds of other hawks fly after it and try to seize that piece of meat. Some peck and stab at the first hawk's body, some at his eyes, some at his head, some to tear away the meat. So many so-called pleasures, like that of possessing political power, are rather like that, especially, I will say, in the highly competitive world and society of today. You can't hold on to anything, you can't enjoy anything without 100 other people trying to snatch it from you, whether it's a good job or whether it's so many other things that you can think of for yourselves. Then the third example given by Dr. Konza is something is pleasant, but it binds us to something else which brings about suffering. And he gives the example of the body, a very simple example which we can all understand. He says through the body we experience all sorts of pleasurable sensations. Because of these pleasurable sensations we become attached to the body, because the body is the source of these sensations. But the body is also the source of unpleasant sensations. So by being attached to that which provides us with the pleasant sensations, we become no less attached to that which provides us with the unpleasant sensations. We can't have them separately. Then lastly, he says, pleasures derived from the experience of conditioned things cannot satisfy the deepest longings of the heart. In us, in each one of us, as I've said before, there is something which is unconditioned, something which is not of this world, as it were, something transcendental, the Buddha nature, call it what you like. But whatever you call it, its distinctive characteristic is that it cannot be satisfied by anything conditioned. It can be satisfied only by the unconditioned. So, whatever conditioned things you give it, whatever conditioned things it enjoys, there's always a lack, always a void, which only the unconditioned can fill. So therefore it can be said, to come back to the Buddha's conclusion, that all conditioned things, whether actually or whether potentially, are unsatisfactory, are suffering. That suffering, unsatisfactoriness, is a characteristic, a basic characteristic, of all forms of conditioned existence, sentient conditioned existence especially.